Again, I'd like to welcome you to today's TechNet webcast. This is Troubleshooting and Debugging Web Hosting Environments. I'm going to hand this on over to Chris Adams and let him take it from there. Chris, you've got the floor.
Awesome. Thank you, Janet. I appreciate it. And welcome, everybody. It looks like we are, once again, looking at the opportunity where, for each attendee, we have someone here to answer your question. So just to make sure that everybody is aware, we are going to be accepting questions in today's presentation throughout. So make sure that you take the opportunity to use that Ask the Answer or Ask the Question feature of live meeting. This is an exciting series this week, and we've had the opportunity to invite Microsoft.com Operations Group over to talk to us about a large amount of information or, you know, perspective on how they run such a busy website, which continually ranks as the number one website in the world for availability. So we started with reliability and the high availability on Monday, went into some more detail on Tuesday, talking about the configuration and then how they do change and release management on Wednesday. We follow up yesterday with how they monitor and manage this incredible environment, and today I'm extremely excited. As many of you may or may not be aware, we have some of the smartest people I know in the world here today, right now, to talk to you about how they go through the process of finding a needle in a haystack. And that's really what it seems to be like over when you're running such a large environment of a, quote, 4.3 million pages. Could you imagine having to manage that environment? Well, you got the folks here that have to find and troubleshoot and debug those web hosting environments. We got an exciting presentation led by Jeff Stuckey, the debug manager for MSCom Operations. So Jeff's going to bring him and his team. We did bring quite a few of them here today, as you can see from our presentation slide here. We're going to go ahead and cut this loose. We're going to have some great demos for you. So with that said, Jeff, you've got the floor.
Thanks, Chris. Welcome, everybody. Today, like Chris said, we're going to cover troubleshooting and debugging. Specifically, what we do as a debug team for troubleshooting our environment. Today, I'm joined with three guys from my team, Jim Dobbin, Will Massar, and Jeff Johnson. So real quick, we'll go into our agenda. I'll give a brief MSCom introduction of who we are and a little information on our environment. And then I'll hand over to Jim to cover Perflon. Will be doing debugging ASP.NET exceptions. Jeff Johnson will be covering log parser and how we use that. And then I'll follow up with Server Performance Advisor, just to kind of give a brief overview of what that is and how we use it. For those of you who haven't taken part of the webcast for earlier this week, we are the Microsoft.com Operations Group. We run a majority of the star.microsoft.com sites, including www, Windows Update, Microsoft Update, Downloads, Windows Media, Support, search.microsoft.com. As far as the debug team, we're a smaller team inside of the operations team. We act as a fourth-tier escalation point for the systems engineers that are running all the various sites. My team handles advanced troubleshooting, analysis, architecture. We also do code reviews. And another functionality that we perform is we work with the Microsoft product teams, the various Windows and other development teams on early product adoption, also affectionately known as dog booting. To give you an idea of our environment, here's the 1,000-foot operational hosting view. We run our sites over three data centers, and we also partner with two content delivery networks for caching, both downloads and web pages, images, and so forth. We run approximately 1,750 data center servers and also over 500 servers in our labs for development and testing. We have 109 websites, over 1,000 databases, and thousands of web applications. At peak load, we push over 80 gigabits a second, 80 gigabits per second of network traffic or internet egress. For our three largest sites, there's some more detailed statistics for Microsoft.com or www.microsoft.com. We have 13 million unique users a day with over 70 million page views per day, 10K requests per second, with 300,000 concurrent connections over A servers, which is a pretty decent load. We have 350 vroots or virtual directories, 190 web apps spread over 12 app pools. Windows Update is probably our heaviest hit site, obviously because of basically most Windows computers in the world hit this site. We have 200 million unique client scans a day, both the interactive and the automatic update feature. 12K ASP.NET requests per second, over 1 million concurrent connections at any given time. Last spring, during a big service pack push, we hit over 1 billion downloads and 750,000 installs in 2 weeks. Without downloads at all, just the internet egress for the website pushes over 4 gigs per second. Downloads, we're getting kind of McDonald's numbers there. 20 plus billion served in 2004, routinely over 150 million downloads a day. This is another big push for our internet egress. Including Microsoft and our caching vendors, we consistently push 30 to 75 gigabits per second. As far as the platform that we run, we are obviously Microsoft products. We run Server 2003 Enterprise Edition and 64-bit Enterprise Edition, which obviously includes Internet Information Server, IIS 6.0. We also run SQL Server 2000 and the soon-to-be-released SQL 2005. SharePoint, CMS 2002. We run MOM 2000 and 2005 for a lot of our monitoring and event collection. And finally, for our applications, we run ASP.NET version 1.1 and also version 2.0, which was released in August on WWDev, which is fully installed. As you know, it hasn't released yet, so that's part of our dogfooding efforts that we undertook. And with that, I'll hand over to Jim Dobbin for performance monitoring.
Thanks, Jeff. Today I'm going to be talking about performance monitoring and how we use it to identify virtual memory pressure, virtual memory fragmentation and some of the common causes, identifying memory leaks in web applications and some of the causes, and steps for further troubleshooting, and identifying excessive garbage collection activity that leads to performance degradation. And I'll show you how to set up and automate collections and deploy to many servers. So PerfMon is usually a starting point in a problem investigation for us that helps us narrow down our focus and provide directions to the next steps needed in the investigation. Here are typically the first PerfMon counters we like to look at when we're investigating some of these memory and GC performance issues. In the following slides, I'll cover some more of these in detail and how we use those. So, virtual memory usage. What is virtual memory? Well, each Win32 process has a 2 gig or 3 gigabytes with the 3GB switch address space available to allocate memory from. And this memory has three possible states: free, reserved, and committed. So process virtual bytes counter is the total of the reserved and committed memory within the process virtual address space, where process private bytes is the total of committed memory. Typically, virtual memory fragmentation occurs when the virtual bytes approaches the address space limit of 2 or 3 gigs. If virtual bytes exceeds the private bytes by a large amount, meaning you have more memory reserved but not committed yet, you're likely seeing a fragmentation of the address space. And badly fragmented memory can lead to system.out-of-memory exceptions from the CLR or ASP.NET, as the CLR basically will not be able to allocate enough contiguous space to grow the managed heap. The CLR needs to virtual alloc memory in 64 meg contiguous blocks. So when your memory becomes fragmented to the point where there's no more 364 meg continuous blocks, that's when it starts throwing the system out of memory exceptions. Typically, memory address space is fragmented to this point when the virtual byte reaches around the 1.3 to 1.4 gigabyte range in the 2 gig address scenario, probably around 1.8 gig in the 3 gig scenario. So you can minimize this, the effects of the system out of memory exceptions, by setting up worker process recycling based on virtual memory in IIS to help avoid room exceptions. But if your virtual memory consumption is happening at a fast enough pace, you may just end up recycling more frequently than you want, and the process and startup time of the CLR may drag your performance down. It's not uncommon in worst-case scenarios to hit the VM limit and recycle in 10 to 20 minutes easily under a heavily loaded server. So you need to dig deeper into the memory being used with other tools to determine the root cause. If you choose VM-based recycling of worker processes, you should also make sure you're logging events for process recycling and monitor the event log for the frequency of VM-based recycle events to make sure you're not anywhere near that 10 to 20 minute range for your recycling. So some of the common causes of fragmentation, too many DLLs loaded. In this case, we'd look at the CLR memory, number of assemblies loaded, and number of bytes and loader heap counters to determine this. A 10th assembly can be generated by a code block within an XFLP, for example. Other causes are too many DLLs loaded, also counted in the number of assemblies, or just too much content. Remember that each ASPX page gets compiled into a DLL and loaded into memory. So if your content is spread out over the file system within many folders, you can end up with too many DLLs loaded. ASPX files located in the same directory should be batch compiled into one DLL. One way to help mitigate this may be to break up the content across more application tools and more worker processes. Some components reserving memory, but not using it, this is more in the native space, is another cause of fragmentation. But these are harder to track down and usually are going to involve lengthy investigation with some of the debugging tools, which Khalil will be talking about later. So, private bytes, as I mentioned before, private bytes is the total committed memory for a process. And memory leaks are generally identified by a steady increase in this counter until the counter approaches the 2 or 3 gig limit of the process virtual space, with the counter never leveling out at a steady running state. Once memory leak has been identified via perfmon, further investigation and other tools are usually needed to find the source of the leak. Memory leaks can occur in the native memory, Win32 heap, or the managed CLRGC heap. Looking at the .NET CLR memory counters, the Gen 0, 1, and 2 heap size counters, and comparing to your private bytes will give you an idea if the leak is in managed code or not. Identifying where the memory leak is occurring, it generally takes the debugger tools. We usually get a memory dump and investigate the memory usage from that, or attach a debugger to the process itself and investigate that way. You can mitigate memory leaks some by recycling the worker processes on the memory use setting, which is private bytes, basically, for the process. But this also has its performance drawbacks. ASP.NET 1.1 uses this recycle setting to determine when it's under memory pressure and aggressively drops items from the cache and calls GC collect when private bytes reaches 80% of this setting. So if your memory pressure increases near the same rate as ASP.NET is freeing items from the cache, meaning your net effect is that you stay at the 80% watermark of the private bytes mark, ASP.NET ends up calling GC collect almost continually, and this has a negative impact on performance and throughput. In ASP.NET 2.0, instead of using the IIS memory recycle threshold to determine memory pressure, they make a more intelligent decision based on physical memory, available memory, and some other checks that they do and provide a few configuration options for controlling the default behavior. So common causes for memory leaks, obviously component not freeing or reusing an allocation, possibly an SAPI filter or COM component or DLL loaded. In the managed space, creating and holding references to too many objects is going to look like or going to cause a memory leak. Also, excessive use of the ASP.NET cache objects can appear like a leak and basically have the same effect. In process, session state, and excessive view state can also lead to memory problems. So once you've identified a memory leak via perfmon, you usually need to dig in a little bit deeper with something like the Windows debugging tools and the SOS DLL extension for managed leaks. And there's several commands within SOS to help you look at some of those managed heaps, basically the dump heap command to investigate managed leaks. And in the native space, you've got the heap command and the VA dump command for native. Newest versions of the SOS extension shipping with framework 2.0, it has some new commands that will also help you investigate virtual memory space, VMMap and VMStat commands. For native leaks, we look at tools like UMDH and LeakDiag. Both good tools for tracking down basically memory leaks, and LeakDiag actually can help you track down calls to virtual alloc as well. So, excessive GC activity or garbage collection. CLR garbage collection is expensive, especially Gen 2 collections, as all the threads in your worker process or the managed threads are suspended until the GC completes. So the server GC creates one heap and one thread per CPU. The GC threads run at a higher priority than the other threads. And Gen 2 collections are the largest and most thorough, so there's more memory to go through. The GC operations are taking too long or happens too frequently, your performance will be affected. So what we look at is the number of Gen collections, the heap sizes for each heap, and basically the percent of time we're spending in GC. I would start probably by looking at the number of bytes in all heaps, and then the individual gen sizes determine sizes of the managed heap, and look at your collection ratios as well. If your ratio of Gen 2 to Gen 1 collections is not near 10 to 1, you could be having problems with your Gen 2 heap. Most likely causes are excessive use of cache as cached items survive into the Gen 2 heap. So keeping an eye on the size of your Gen 2 heap will give you a good idea, typically, of how much stuff is ending up in cache. You'll probably see the Gen 2 heap grow to be the largest one. Ideal ratios of Gen collections should be 10 to 1. So Gen 0 should be 10x of Gen 1, and Gen 1 should be 10x of Gen 2. Now, these are ideal situations, so as your ratios get closer to the 1-to-1 mark, performance is degraded and cause your time in percent GC to rise. Ideally, we want to see percent time in GC should be less than 5%, but that depends on your application, of course, your load, and what you consider to be acceptable performance. So, common causes for excessive GC activity, too many allocations per request, creating too many objects on a per request basis, excessive use of the ASP.NET cache again, large data sets being loaded into memory, excessive view state, those type of things in the managed world are what's going to cause your excessive GC activity. And the tools we usually use to diagnose this is often we'll just use code review, and do the, if we know the code that's causing it, we can often make small changes that can reduce the number of allocations, greatly reducing GC time. Things like creating objects within loops, large string concatenations, optimizing these types of things can have a big effect on your GC. CLR Profiler is another tool that we use, but mainly in a test-type environment. CLR Profiler is fairly intrusive and can't really be run in a production environment, but if you can profile a single request or a light stress for a couple of minutes, it can usually give you some pretty good information as far as your allocation patterns go. Automating perf mon collection and keeping rolling perf logs on all your machines means that you can take a look at this data anytime. Performance data is most valuable when you have a baseline of where you normally run, and live running logs should an abnormality come up. Here's how we set this up. Create the counters file. The counters file is basically just a text file with the counters you're interested in logging. It's usually easiest to set up the logging using the perfmon UI on one box and export these settings from the UI or use the logman query to export them to a file. Either way, still requires some manual editing to come up with the format logman uses to create new logs. The basic format is illustrated here, string representation of each counter enclosed in quotes. And just you would use, once you've got one set up on a machine, you could use logman query, collection name, and pipe it to a file to get an idea of what the format should look like. So once you've created your collection file, your counters file, you would use the logman create counter command to roll it out to other machines. Logman, in this example here, name is the log name, my log. Minus F is for the server name. It is remotable. Minus F is the file type. This one is a binary circular log. And the dash max, where maximum size in megabytes is 300. Minus F size are a sample interval, so every 3 seconds. We've got our minus O for our path to where our perf log is, and minus CF is, that's our counters file that we created previously. So once you've got that done, and basically you just need to start the log. The command line to start the log is just logman start, my log name again, and basically your server. Since logman is command line utility, commands can be scripted in a batch file to roll it out consistent logs to a number of servers. And, of course, logman/?? For help. And that's how we do it here for setting up perfmon collections. So I'll turn this over now to Khalil Nassar, who's going to do managing or debugging ASP.NET exceptions.
Thank you, Jim. I'm going to talk about debugging today, a little bit of overall high-level stuff, and then dig into some ASP-specific or manage-specific debugging. When approaching a problem, probably the lowest level approach would be to attach a debugger to a process or a machine, and sometimes it's overkill, but sometimes it can be very revealing and very quick. But in the process in general, we want to look at a few things before we get to the debugger, namely the event viewer and perfmon. A lot of times you'll attach the debugger, you'll be pulling your hair out and you go look at Event Viewer, and boom, there's some sort of indication of what the problem is, or it'll put you on a new direction as to where to focus your debug. Next, we move into actual debugging, connecting a debugger to a misbehaving process. And in the area of managed debugging, we're mostly going to key off of exceptions. And that's why I have the real-time exception viewing bullet there. Finally, outside of the classical debugging mechanism of looking a debugger up to the target process, we can use Visual Studio, which is a more full-blown approach where you'd be loading the full IDE on the problem machine and the solution that correlates to the process that's failing. So for the Event Viewer bullet, I didn't have a more drawn-out slide on that. We get the idea there. It's just a good place to start out with. For exceptions, there's a couple things that usually come to mind. And the environment that we're dealing with here, the focus, the mindset is more towards ASP.NET web pages. And what we're dealing with there, like I mentioned before, are exceptions. So just to back up a little bit, in managed debugging, actually in standard debugging or native debugging, we have the luxury of attaching a debugger to a process and doing a thing called, we call source-level debugging, where we can get to a source code line of interest and step through those lines step by step, examine registers or local variables, etc. In managed debugging, we don't have that luxury normally, but the whole paradigm is based off of exceptions, and we do have a more high-level indication of code flow. And that's via exceptions. So we would take the debugger, hook it up to the target process, and look at exceptions, which we're going to see in a demo shortly. We could also take a much simpler approach and just fire up Perfmon and monitor the exceptions per second, or the total number of exceptions. And that will give us an indication. Generally, exceptions in this sense are things going wrong. That might not always be true, but it might be the code looking for a file or trying to handle a response or any number of things that could happen but weren't able to complete for one reason or another, usually end up causing time in the code flow, and therefore that they failed out, and that's why it's a concern to us. We want to try to understand these exceptions and try to fix them. They could be as a result of lazy coding or resources just not being available on the network, etc. Another Perfmon counter that comes to mind is loading assemblies, so I put that there. If you happen to have an assembly leak, maybe not through a developer that was consciously thinking of being conserving resources and just kind of being a little bit sloppy. And over time, on a system where you have thousands of hits per second, etc., address space gets filled up pretty quickly with these guys, maybe after a couple hours or even half hour, depending on the load. get started, I want to mention the debug tools package and a couple of the key extension that we're concerned with regard to managed debugging. So the tools package is up there on the Microsoft site, and I always recommend downloading the latest beta version of that. Typically, there will be a quarterly release, and then there will be a more recent beta release. And the debug tools dev team is turning out debuggers quite frequently. Fixing bugs, adding features, etc. So it behooves all of us to stay current with the latest debugger tools. The SOS extension is what we use in the managed world for debugging. And there are essentially two versions. There's one that comes in the framework directory. And I give example for the 1.1 and 2.0 frameworks. And then there's one that ships with the debugger package itself and off of the root of the debug tools install to the CLR10 directory, and that's where the sos.dll lives. I generally use the SOS that ships in the framework. It's possible that they have a large set of crossover. They have a lot of common commands. Some of them, the latest framework version has more commands and more commands that tailor to the framework. Latest and greatest features. I want to go over a few commands, kind of the bread and butter commands for debugging managed targets. The bang BAE dump all exceptions command is a good overview of what has been happening in the recent past of a particular target's execution. The SXD CLR command. SX for the debugger stands for set exceptions. And when you append an E onto it, that means enable. Or if you were to append a D onto that, it would be disable. And with the CLR mnemonic, we are with the FXD space CLR command, we're enabling the debugger to catch all exceptions and handle exceptions for anything CLR related. The bang DSO dump stack objects is an excellent command for displaying the objects that have been accumulated or are currently being used in the code progression, specifically of managed code. When we drill into the output of the bang DSO command, when we look at individual objects, we use the bang DO command, dump objects. And to look at code progression, we have our kind of standard call stack command, bang CLR stack. It has the intelligence to be able to scale managed code as opposed to, say, KV or K in the native world. A variation on SXD, the SXD space CLR space dash C space quote bang CLR stack semicolon G end quote. That's actually incorrect. That CLR part should go at the very end. That allows you to spew out your call stacks every time a managed exception occurs and then continue execution. So it's a good way of getting a barometer of what type of exceptions you're having at a given point in time or a collection over several minutes, but also what code progression led up to those exceptions. Finally, the bang new command is just the simple unassemble command for managed code. It has a nicer D to it when you, I think that's better than say the U command for native when you issue bang you against an address, as we'll see, it gives you the entire function output from beginning to end of the assembly, and then it points out to you where the address is that you're interested in particular. So it's a nice feature, and then it lets you see before and after your point of interest. Another tool we sometimes resort to in managed debugging, it's usually not necessary, but sometimes it's very helpful, is decompiling. And I list a few vendors here that I'm familiar with and that I've used. I was up on the MSDN site the other day, and I noticed the free 30-day trial, I forget what it was, for the Jungle Creatures decompiler. So what you can do when you're debugging a target is use this bang save module command, and that's off of SOS. And that will actually allow you to write out your managed DLL to the file system. You could then take that DLL and feed it to one of these decompilers. You could then examine all the high-level source that was used to derive that binary. So you can take things quite far when debugging, and if you're not the actual developer of the code, you can then examine the code and possibly figure out the problem and send the fix off to the developer. Kind of a ace up the sleeve thing that I keep in mind, but I don't use too often is what I mentioned earlier, debugging with the IDE. It's a big step, and it's something you typically wouldn't do on a production system. But you can have the full lushness of source level debugging when your target is managed if you go this route. So you have, let's say you have a managed service running on a target, and you're having a problem with this. You could install the IDE, load up the solution for that managed service, and then do a debug attach from within the IDE to that process, and then you're all hooked up. Then you're actually able to source level debug, breakpoints, stepping through code, variable values, etc. They're all available to you. And that, I have that in the second demo, basics of doing that. So what I mentioned a little bit earlier with regard to the decompiling is taking it to the next step once you do use a debugger or whatever tool necessary to get down to the point of failure or the point that you can't go on anymore effectively time-wise. You want to take it to the next step. But typically, with most of this code, you're going to be able to figure out the problems and go work directly with test or product development. Sometimes app settings are missing or whatnot, and it's something that you can do pretty easily. Once you get by, I'll go fix the machine. Okay, debugging demos.
Anyone there? Did we lose you?
Hello.
Camille?
No, I'm clicking around. It didn't do what I wanted it to do.
Okay, I was just making sure we didn't lose your audio.
Okay. Sorry about that, Chris. Still here. I want to share out a terminal server session for the debug that I have set up. I think I'll try an alternate route. And this seems to be working. Okay. Hello, I'm still here. Click on the sharing slide.
Hey, Will, I can see you on the screen now.
Okay, can you see the W3WP?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you're good. And if everybody wants to go ahead and push F5, that'll go full screen, really helps them see your whole entire screen.
Okay, my bad.
Oh, no, you're good to go.
All right, what we have here is a set of web pages based off of the ASP.NET Forums project that was available from iBytespy a couple years ago, the original 1.0 version. I always like to use that as kind of my test bed for new versions of the CLR and just various things that you wouldn't maybe normally expect to do with it. So I have it right here. I'll bring up the site, and on this particular machine, which is 2003 SP1 standard server, I am running the 2.0 CLR, and I have registered all the ASP stuff so that this web page is using the new framework. So we poke around the web page, and everything kind of looks normal. I don't see any apparent problems. But let's say we get reports from operations that things are slowing down, and they'd like us to investigate this particular website. So I'll bring up Perfmon just out of curiosity and see what kind of exceptions we're dealing with here, if any. So I'll go to CLR exceptions, and I'll just look at exceptions thrown for W3WP, which is the server side to that website. Okay, get that smaller. And once again, we'll poke around and just get an idea for what we're dealing with in terms of exceptions here. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so we are throwing up exceptions. Might not really be a concern, you know, for the single user type website, but when you have thousands of hits a minute, this really adds up. And perf can potentially be an issue. So we use Perfmon to very easily identify that something's happening under the covers with this particular app pool that is servicing this web page. And let's go ahead and peek under the covers and see what's going on. So I used the ISFVB script to determine what app pools are running on the server. Just have one. It's got that process ID. I've pre-installed my debug tools, and I put the debug tools root directory in my path. And I'm going to call it CDB. Real quickly, with the debug package, it ships with four debuggers, CDB, NTSC, KD, and WinDBG. That all front ends onto a common engine. They're all essentially the same debugger. The only difference is WinDBG is graphical, and it gives you a lusher environment for debugging source level. Though you could do source level with any of the command line debuggers. So a quick and dirty debugger, CDB, is just a command line debugger. I'm going to point to the symbol path and attach to the process of interest. And I'm attached. And another way of just taking a peek under the covers is, so when we first attach the debugger to the target process, it hits the initial debug breakpoint, and it's waiting for us to do something. Hit G to go. Now that target process is running again, we can just start poking around the website again, and we see something's happening. and the debugger. So basically for every operation we see about four, we see about four exceptions occurring for operation. To dig deeper, let's break in and start issuing some commands. We can just do the basic FSCCLR. And all that's going to do is break out to the debugger when one of the CLR exceptions occurs. The CLR exceptions are specifically, it specifically generates this code right here. So we're telling the debugger to specifically force on that anytime that code is generated by the exception handler. Break out to the debugger. So, poke around again, boom. Get our first exception. And let's have a look at the code flow that led up to that exception. Now you'll see that I issued the CLR stack command and didn't have any joy. So by default, the debugger doesn't know about SLS. So I'm going to fully qualify the framework directory. Just grab that there. And reissue the command, list framework directory, and then SLS. And for those not familiar with debugging, the way we tap into the commands that are available in the extension is we use the dot nomenclature. And that'll get us our CLR stack or our call stack that shows the flow of code up to the point of execution or of the exception. So I generally like to key in on the code that I know belongs to the, should I say, non-system code, because in my mind, I typically hold that responsible as causing the problem, as opposed to the system code, though the system code could potentially be at fault. Just a quick peruse at, the actual unassembly of this code that correlates to that. Let's kind of pause here for a second. So we'll get this big view from start to finish of the function. And we have the three greater than signs that show us where the address is actually the address after the instruction pointer that we're interested in. And when I'm doing this quick peruse, I'm looking for easy stuff, stuff that I can understand, like text strings and that type of thing. And I don't see anything just yet. We may come back to this later and dig into it deeper, but that's kind of interesting, but not really interesting. So now I'm going to use the bang DSO command, dump stack objects. And this is going to have the all the objects that were utilized that correlates to that CLR stack. And just for demonstration purposes, usually what I end up doing is a semi-intelligent poking around of these values. Just saying DO will give us a further focus or further details on those objects. But what's interesting to us right here is usually you want to start at the top. Let's just see what we got here. Grab that message. And we'll see, it'll pop out exactly what the problem is. So we're missing a page. Now, a lot of times, that kind of thing will pop out on the client side. And you wouldn't need to go to the debugger. This is all the stuff that we're dealing with now. It's kind of hidden. It's kind of perf stuff. It obviously the site works, so it might not be crucial, or it might be interesting. You never know. But the reason we'd be looking at it is because we discovered that positive exceptions were being generated, and we wanted to find out why. So I would then go into my site and have that file if it's supposed to be around, or if I don't care about it. Just go on. So I go to target process and Boom, right again, I hit another exception. See if it's the same old guy. So we wouldn't be so interested. This is a little different. Let's say DSO again. Because that's probably where the money is. And actually, that is the same as that. That's a different one. Okay. Same idea, though. There's another exception I want you to see here. Okay, here's a thread aboard where somebody threw up their hands and said, you know, I need to get out of this situation. Typically, generally what I classify as not the best coding practice, especially if synchronization is an issue with code and other parts of code are potentially relying on the state of this code that thread aborts and things aren't cleaned up properly, I always pay close attention to thread aborts and try to hunt them down. Nothing special there. And then another thing I wanted to show you was expanding on the SXE command. Like I mentioned, the CLR goes at the end. Semicolon G, we can string along commands. As long as that'll work in sequence, as long as the commands, as long as you don't use commands that cause execution to occur, you can string them along like that. So, let's check in something wrong there. I don't know what I did. Try that again. Got my CLR. Okay, so now, as we go through this guy, so he timed out. Should we try it? We'll see more detail on the exceptions. Oops. Let me see how my I think in the interest of time I'm gonna go ahead and turn it over to Jeff Johnson. And just suffice to say that this is just scratching the surface. There's quite a bit to debugging and a lot to get into, and it's fascinating stuff, but it's rewarding that you can just start poking around like this and stuff bubbles up, stuff pops out of like missing pages and whatnot. And it's potentially a very quick way to solve problems. So with that, I'd like to turn over to Jeff.
Jeff, you there?
I am here, and I had my mute button on, but boy, was I going great.
Sounded like it. It looked like you were just making a lot of progress there.
Good job, Jeff. I was on 5.3. Welcome to the party again. Let's go, buddy.
Okay. My talk is on log pressure. It is one of my favorite tools, and sometimes there is just way too much data in the world. We have too many sources of data, including the IS logs, the event logs, the file system. We have way too many items. Now, if we go back to the beginning of this deck, we talked about getting 250,000 requests per second. Each of those generate interesting data that we can use to understand how our system is operating. We have a lot of questions to answer. Where do all our resources go? Who's doing that? What's broken? When did content last change? And in general, just what's going on here? So, enter log parser, the electronic Swiss Army knife. It takes many kinds of input, event logs, IS logs, file systems. We named some of those already. It can also work with netmon files. It can work with text files, XML files. It can look at ETW event tracing for Windows files. It can look at the registry, and you can query a domain service with it. It can group, it can sort, it can count, and it can manipulate data pretty much any way you want to. It uses an expanded subset of the SQL language. Now, that sounds like an oxymoron, but what it is that not all of the SQL language was implemented, but after the parts that were implemented, a bunch of new features were added to make it easier to work with text data in a day-to-day basis. It has a command line implementation, but it also exposes COM objects, so you can use it from the script, or you can use it from C#. And best of all, it's free. Oh, but wait, more importantly, it actually does work. Our common uses for log parser. We use it to understand the HTTP load we see. Right? Do we have pages failing? How many requests per second are we doing? How many concurrent connections do we have, or did we have yesterday, the day before, the day before? Do we have hot users, meaning a user that's really hitting our site a lot? Maybe it's an attack. We can also do per URL load analysis. So are some URLs hotter than other URLs, and have they been changing over time? We can roll up our system events, and that's just for those days when everything isn't going well. Not too long ago, we rolled out the .NET 2.0 version, and we were filling up our event log on a daily basis. And it was nice to be able to use log parser to help figure out what's going on there and solve those problems. We can also use it for forensic analysis, about who did what when. There are some great articles on the web about using it that way. Today I'm going to be focusing on some simple examples, and we're going to start with a basic one. That is, we're going to go look for errors. Because if we find errors, then we can use some of these other tools we've discussed and will discuss to find out what's going wrong. But first, we need to know that something is going wrong. And rather than wait for customers to complain to us, we can proactively go find out. So I'm going to use the command line version of log parser. And if you had log parser installed, and if you were in the directory and you had a given log file sitting there, you could just copy and paste this statement right into your CMD prompt. It starts with log parser, the executable's name, and then it's a SQL query. And for those who are familiar with SQL, it will feel really easy and nice. And for those who aren't, it won't be hard to learn. Just a few days of work with log parser, you'll be amazed by your progress in SQL. We start with a select, so we're going to go get data. What are we going to get? We're going to get the FC status field. Now, FC status is one of the log fields that is on by default. We're going to count the number of rows that have that we match a certain clause. And we're also going to get the percentage of those rows that match that clause. We're getting it into a nice CSV file, which we could then load up in Excel if we wanted to, or we could reparse it with log parser at a later date. We're taking it from an IIS log, which is a very standard output log for IIS. Now we're going to group by the status field and order by the status field. So what this means is all of the 200 OK responses are going to be grouped together, and then we're going to order it by that status. If we wanted to order it by the number of hits, so how often we see that status, we could just as easily put the word hits here, and it would change the output order. So I took a machine log file and ran it on my nice 64-bit box that I use in my office, and in just under 2 minutes, it parsed a 3.2 gigabyte log file. That's 14.5 million entries. That's 14.5 million responses parsed. But that's not what I'm showing you. I'm actually showing you the output from a 155 megabyte log file, which is, as I show here, about 640,000 entries, and it parsed that in just under 5 seconds. So log parser can parse about 100,000 requests per second in this simple query, which is more than most people have to deal with on a daily basis. We see the output here. It's comma delimited. You can see the commas in there. And it shows you a header line with FC status, hits, and the percent. And we see down the left side the different status codes. These are the HTTP status codes. So a 200 OK, a 404 not found. We can see that during this particular time period that this log was generated, about 93% of all of our responses were 200 OKs. But we do look down and we see 264 500 errors. Now, 500 is a server error. That means something bad is happening, and we should probably go investigate that. We might also be interested in the 404s, because that means content isn't being found. That could mean that there are bad links, and we could go look and find out who referred that content, or it could just be that somebody had a not updated bookmark that they've been holding on to for years. Now, I'm going to take that simple example, and I'm going to make it a little more complicated, because it might not be so interesting to know that we got 93% 200 OKs. What we really want to know is which of the content on our site produced those 500 errors. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add a bunch of nasty-looking code to figure out which virtual directory the content belongs to. Now, we could just do some more simple things and just find out the exact URLs that return the 500 error. But in this case, I wanted to produce data to hand back to our content providers to let them understand their status code distribution for their content at a global level. So we have the same log parser command right up there at the front. And then we select, and then I have a large case statement. Now this case statement is doing nothing more than parsing the URI that's given, and it's renaming it as a virtual, just the virtual directory part. And if you look closely, what we do, now that I've gotten it all yellow, is we count how many forward slashes exist in the URI. If there are zero of them, which would be an invalid request, I check for it anyway, or if there's only one of them, then that means we're in the root vector. In that case, I'm just going to give back the string forward slash. Now, it might be better to actually say root or bottom or whatever makes it better for you, but I'm just going to put the forward slash. Otherwise, the else statement, we're going to extract a token. What extract token does is it splits the string based on some criteria that you give. In this case, we are looking for forward slashes, and we're going to take the first forward slash, the first token between the forward slashes. Now, this is actually a zero-based counting system, so we wouldn't actually get the first, we wouldn't get the token before the first forward slash. We would get the token after the first forward slash, but before the second forward slash. Then we're getting the same data we had before, the status code, and the number of hits, and the percentage of hits, but notice that we changed it. Now we say on Vdir. What that does is it makes that percentage specific only to the Vdir. Rather than having 93% of all hits, we look at each individual Vdir and we give that percentage. And if you look down in the output, you can see that for the root Vdir, we have 97% of our hits. Ooh, that was not quite right. 97% of our hits were 200 OKs. In the access meter, we had 100% of our hits were 200 OKs. So they can each have the percentage match just that meter. And we're still outputting to a single CSV file from the same file, and we're grouping by, we added the meter to the group by to make sure that we do have it grouped that way. Now, on my notes, you can see that if we change the into parameter to something that looked like status codes / asterisk.csv, we would actually get a single file for every Vdir. And each Vdir entry would look like the previous slide's output. So we could have a slide for access, and we could have, not a slide, a CSV file for access, and a CSV file for Argentina, and a CSV file for forward slash. That is why I would say you probably want to switch from forward slash to the word root or something similar. So this is how we could produce data for a large number of content owners so they can understand what their content is doing on the web servers. I'm moving on to another example. when we rolled out WIDBI, we saw a lot of event messages that looked like the example on the screen right now. We can see that if a WIDBI error, ASP.NET 2.0.50727, and it has an event code, and an event message, and a timestamp, and a bunch of more information. And we can scroll down and we can see a lot of information if we wanted to, including even the stack call that produced the event. Well, it's very difficult to look through hundreds or maybe even thousands of these and try to figure out if there's a pattern or what the commonalities are. So we brought out LogParser. In this case, we are once again using the exe. We're doing a select from application. Now, this is a special keyword LogParser uses. It has application, it has system, and it has security. Those three keywords tell it to go to the event log and do the select from events in the event log. Now, we have a clause that tells us to only get events that match what's going on behind there. In this case, we're only looking for events where the source name field is ASP.NET 2.0.50727.0, which is exactly what we saw in the last slide. Below, we have the output from this select statement. In this case, we had a compilation error has occurred. Now, if we look carefully through this output, we notice that this is the strings field, and this appears to be concatenated by the pipe sign. Well, since we know about the handy-dandy extract token, we can write a little log parser script to break out any part of this strings field that we want and return just that, including down here at the bottom we have, starting with at, it says our call stack, which means we can now go parse out just the call stack and return that and take that with us to the developer and ask him to fix his content for us. We also have the URL that was asked for, so we know exactly what we need to go fix. So, after a bit of modification and fun, we produced this more complicated, so-called simple, log parser script. If we look at it, we're getting the minimum time and the maximum time. That way we can know when we started to see this error and when we stopped seeing this error, if they are specific to some time period. We need this in case we need to go correlate to other machines, maybe a SQL server on the back end or a middle tier web server that's also showing errors. Now, we're getting the hits so we can see how often we're getting this error or how many of these we've seen, so we can prioritize the important ones and the not important ones, the important ones being ones customers run into. And then we have a number of case statements where we're parsing out that strings field. And we're changing the string based on the event ID. What we found is, while they are always delimited by pipe symbols, they're not always formatted in the same order. So sometimes the URL is in a different spot, or the message is in a different spot. Even possibly the stack is in a different spot. In this case, what are we looking for? We're looking for the error, the message, and the URL. So we're not bothering with the stack, because all we really need to know is what the string said the problem was, what the full error message was, and then which URL we want to send this to so we can go get the right person fixing the problem. We continue to have our source name clause to make sure that we're only looking at ASP.NET errors, because this parsing would probably fail on any other kind of errors. We have to have per event type parsing happening. We're going to be grouping by the URL and the error and the message, and then we're going to be ordering by the hit in descending order. That way we can see the most important thing to fix at the top. Once again, the most important thing to find as the one that most customers are seeing. So here's the output from that simple example. We see the number 3, which is the hits. We see that it was an HTTP compile exception. We see the actual page, not the URL, notice that, we actually parse out something a little bit different than what we said we were going to parse out. And then we show the actual error exception string. So it says, system web HTTP response does not contain the definition for WITE, W-I-T-E. And our second one, it says, does not contain the definition for write, R-I-T-E. And then we actually have the URL. So what we see here is, obviously I made a bad page to show off the example. And it tells us exactly what's wrong with the page. I can take this, I can either go edit the page, or more appropriately for Microsoft.com, I can go to the content provider and show them what's wrong with their page. Now here's another simple example with LogPressure. Sometimes you'd like to know when the things were edited last. Maybe you think you've been attacked and you want to see what they touched. Maybe you just want to see when the last time some of your content was edited to make sure that the different machines are in sync. To do this, we can use LogParser's file system input format. So once again, we start with our EXE LogParser. This time we're giving a -IFS, and we need to do that because LogParser won't be able to tell if you want to use the file system or if you actually want to parse each of the files in your select statement. We're going to recurse with a parameter of -1, and we're doing this because we actually want to go through all the files down below through from where we start to the bottom. We're going to reserve last access time. That way we make LogParser a ghost. This is important if you're going to reparse and reparse to see when people are accessing files. You want to make sure LogParser isn't the thing accessing the file. Then we have our select statement, in which we look for the last write time and the path. A very simple statement here. The last write time is the last time that somebody changed the file, and then we'll get the full path to the file that was changed. Where are we going? I went down to System32 directory, and I look for all the files under System32. That way I could see when they were edited last. Ordering by the last time files are written, and we're going to do that descending so we can see the most recent first. I chopped off the output because it was extremely long, but you can see we have last write time and a path. You'll notice in this select statement I didn't say into anything. And the default format for LogParser when we don't give that is your standard space-limited output, which is very readable and fairly parsable. But we can see we have last write time and the path. And we can see that on 2005, October 24th, the software.log file was edited. And if I ran this every day, I could get a good idea of what's getting modified on a daily basis and keep a record, if I ever needed to. And with LogParser's ability to output to a database, I could keep a much longer-term view of what's changing on my system as it changes. While I love LogParser, it does have a few limitations. It is only an execution engine. By itself, it can't solve any problems. You have to do the interesting work and make the interesting queries. It runs a parse of whatever you're parsing per query. So if you want to look at the first three fields of a file, and then you want to do something fun with them, and then you come back and want to do something fun with the second three fields of a file, not rows, but fields, you'd have to reparse the whole file for each of those queries. If you're doing the same query over and over again, and you're just changing the minimum time period, then you can checkpoint or save your progress. But if you want to run two different queries against log, you will have to parse the whole thing twice. Given its speed, that's not that big of an issue. Most people don't mind 100,000 rows per second. If I have to do five different parses, that still means I could do 20,000 rows per second and get them all done. Also, there is no join operation yet. And I say the yet because there is enough update to LogParser coming. I don't have a when, but I know it is. Now, where do you get LogParser? Well, my favorite place to go for LogParser things in general is www.logparser.com. Now, this is the unofficial home of LogParser. It was created by a person who does not work for Microsoft and is not affiliated, as far as I know, with Microsoft. But he just really loved LogPrusher, so he asked for permission and we gave it to him. You can't download LogPrusher from there, but you can get it from Microsoft.com. I'll type this in here. /downloads. And that didn't come out nearly as high as I thought it would. So, LogPrusher is a great tool, freely available. It does what you need it to do when you need it to do it, but it does exactly what you tell it to do. The magic is all in you, and you can make the queries that are fun. The TechNet blog for Microsoft.com operations team has some wonderful samples for LogPrusher. Everything from understanding the performance of your website to security analysis of the website. And I know that we have TechNet articles coming out in the near future that will also include LogPrusher queries. With that, I'm going to conclude LogPrusher just by saying I encourage you to use it because it will save you time in understanding what's going on in your system. I'm going to turn the time over to Mr. Jeff Stuckey to tell us about Server Performance Advisor, or SPAR.
Thanks, Jeff. That was awesome. LogPrusher demos. Quickly, we're just to get through this, so we have a little bit of time for questions. I'm going to zoom through SPA. At the end of this, also have a link to a more in-depth webcast that Chris Adams did on SPA. So, quick agenda. I'll talk about what SPA is, how it works, when you should think about using it, and then how we in MSCOM use it, and just give you a quick demo of a report that was generated with SPA. So SPA is a GUI-based tool that ties into some core plumbing in the OS for gathering very comprehensive performance data about your server. You can use SPA can be used on an ad hoc or an automated scheduled basis to collect data. It has very low overhead just by the nature of how it ties into the OS. And the reports that it generates are very detailed and very insightful in determining server performance. So how it works, the components that I was talking about, it ties into WMI for gathering the performance side, performance counter data, and also ties into ETW or event tracing for Windows for gathering all of the other trace data from both the kernel side and user mode side, or IIS is what we're most interested in, but any application can subscribe to ETW for posting trace data. After it gathers the data, it then has a report generation phase where utility runs to make sense of, basically make sense of all of the tracing data and align the data in terms of requests, and then it determines based on pre-selected benchmarks or watermarks of what a healthy server looks like. Another option that it has that we actually use is for transferring that data after it's collected to a centralized location where you can have a dedicated processor that handles generating those reports. So when should you think about using it? If you have a performance issue that is kind of generic and you're not sure exactly where it is occurring, SPA could definitely help you localize where that issue lies. For determining capacity, either current or future capacity of your hardware, SPA is great for that. It's great for benchmarking how your website content is performing and finding outliers there of poorly performing content or even great performing content to use as a model for other content as far as the coding standards that they use. And it's also good for just day-to-day monitoring and alerting of server performance if your servers start performing poorly one day for no apparent reason. It's great for monitoring that. What we do here at MSCOM, we use it primarily just as a historic performance benchmark. What we have set up is all of our clusters of our various sites will pick a node from that cluster, since the load to each cluster or load to one server is very representative of the load to that cluster. We take one node and we'll get Spaw installed on that, and we'll set up a scheduled collection of data, usually during our peak time of load, because that's generally what we're most interested in, but sometimes we'll schedule, for instance, 4 or 6 collections throughout the day. But generally it's during our peak load. And then that gets sent over to a dedicated machine that we have just for ripping through that data and generating the reports. We do use it on a limited ad hoc basis if we run into high priority issues that need attention. We'll fix Spaw on it. Generally, I would say our team has the technical know-how to just pull up a quick perf on and isolate a performance issue, but Spaw can still be beneficial in that. And then for sure, across our whole team of systems engineers, it's an easier avenue for them to localize performance issues than the kind of work that the debug team does. We also use it for generating, since it does such a nice job on the reports and giving that rich information, we use it for generating comparison reports for like a new app deployment or a new version of an app where we can compare the current version and then the performance of the new version. We also use it for our product adoption. Say we're running Windows Server 2003 and we want to compare that with SP1, we can use Spaw to generate nice executive reports for that. With that, I'll just show you a quick report that I have generated from a real web server, which has been renamed to Web Server 1 to protect the innocent. So here's a sample of the kind of data that we get. I think this is probably from one of our, www.microsoft.com server. As you can see, it's 26% CPU utilization, 212 requests per second. Pretty ho-hum. Spaw gives you some nice links on the side where you can just zoom into specific areas that you're looking for. We'll look real quick at the system health. So Spaw has, like I said, watermarks of performance where it starts considering your server, under stress or poorly performing, and it starts going from a sun, which is what we see for the network, to partly cloudy under CPU. I feel like the weatherman here. 26% CPU is just partly cloudy, and our memory usage, though, is, I don't know if we got a storm coming on or what, but this is a little misleading. I think they're determining these memory usage based off of available memory as a percentage, but we have like 16 gigs installed in the machine, so it's not quite as disastrous as it might seem. Scrolling down here in this report, we'll get down to very basic HP CPU usage. You can see as a breakdown where your CPU utilization is being spent. One issue that Spaw helped us track down was actually we were seeing high CPU utilization during our initial Server 2003 product adoption under static content. And we couldn't figure out what was going on, and it turned out we were not taking advantage of the HTTP SIF kernel caching for our static content because of some settings we had for a particular filter. So that was great to identify that. You get your response statistics, and scroll down here a little bit, and we get down to the URL breakouts, and this is where it gets really fun. You can start identifying particular URLs that are very heavy and consuming a lot of CPU time, and exactly what area, whether it's IIS or just the SAPI part, that URL is wasting all your CPU utilization. You can see your request rate, and probably my favorite one is your URL with the longest response time. This is where you see pages that are most likely have issues, or you're having some kind of issues with your back-end dependencies for these pages, this is great for ferreting those things out. You can also start looking at your clients that are hitting your site and seeing if there's any particular malicious activity going on or you know, other funny stuff going on. And it goes all the way down to a breakout for your HTTP status codes. This isn't really a replacement for the awesome work that Jeff did in LogPerfect, because SPA really only runs in short bursts just by the amount of data that it collects. Like, typically we just run it for a 5-minute period, and it can generate up to like a gig worth of data. So it's not something that you're going to want to run all of the time. With version 2, they have a circular logging feature, which is pretty cool. You can just have it, you can stop it when you have hit an issue that you're interested in. So that's a pretty useful feature. And then near the bottom, it starts getting into all of your performance counters that you can look at, and you can look at this either in this report view, or you can actually look at it in a regular perfmon graph style look. And it starts getting into system level counters that you can look at. A lot of it's really a lot of information. Usually it's good enough to start at the top, look at system health, and go from there to isolate your performance issue. So with that quick demo, I would encourage you guys to check out SPA. It is downloadable, and looks like I might have even lost our slide there. We had something interjected here. So it's downloadable. Like I said, Chris Adams did a webcast previously this week that I would check out to get better, more detailed information about SPA. Also wanted to point out the IIS webcast series and also our blog site, which I'm told is getting very popular and definitely has a lot of information. I know my team contributes a lot of great stuff to it, so I definitely recommend checking that out. And I'll hand it over to Chris.
Awesome. Well, appreciate it, Sonny, and for those that don't know, that's what I call him. I don't call him by his first name, but great piece of information there on the Service Performance Advisor, as well as Jeff. Thank you for all of your work on the log parser. As you said, it is a powerful utility. But first, I want to go ahead and just say thank you to all of you, especially I've seen some repeated names throughout the week. I know that you have taken 90 minutes out of your day each day this week to spend with us. I hope that you've had as much fun as we've had. And I want to thank personally George Holman for organizing and pushing all of these operations engineers. These folks like to work with technology. They don't necessarily like to get up and talk about it. So it takes a ringleader to get them all rounded up, and I do greatly appreciate George's work in that area as well. And then last but not least, thank you to you for coming, and we appreciate you participating. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another exciting topic in regards to SSL and host header support in Service Pack 1. With that said, go ahead and take this opportunity to ask any questions you have while you have these smart people on the hook, and I will turn the floor back over to Janet.
Excellent. Thanks, Chris. I just want to remind everybody real quick, too, that you can print a PDF of the slides by going to your file menu in your top navigation bar. I know a lot of people have been asking for that information. There's some great URLs that we have posted here. So I want to also let you know, like Chris said, if you have any questions, go ahead and submit those now. We'll get to those in just a moment. We do record all of our webcasts, so if you'd like to see any of our previously recorded webcasts as well as anything that's coming up, you can go to Microsoft.com/webcast, and they are all posted there. I'm also going to point out, too, that custom panel, which you'll see over there on the left-hand side of your console, has the links related with the related resources for today's webcast, so lots of great information there as well on IIS. There's also, if you have any content ideas or anything that you'd like to see us do differently, we'd love to hear from you. Get another URL posted there. And then I just want to point out that today's webcast was presented using that Microsoft Office Live Meeting technology. So you can get a free 14-day trial. Just go to Microsoft.com/presentlive. We have a survey coming up here. I'm going to let you know that just to fill out that survey, you're going to be automatically entered into a drawing to win the Creative Zen Portable Media Center. So a little incentive there as well, but your feedback is very valuable to us. So please do take a moment to fill out that survey prior to logging out. We really appreciate that. And with that, I'm going to hand it back over to you, gentlemen, see if you want to wrap up with any last-minute questions or concerns.
Awesome. Yeah, that would be great if we could get a couple of extra minutes. I know we're running over here, but if you're willing to stay with us, Janet, we'll stay here. Is that okay for a couple more minutes?
I believe so. Right? If anyone here is able to stay with us, then you're welcome, and we'll do a quick Q&A here.
Great. Hey, Jeff, do you see any good questions that you want to throw out there that we might can capture for the on-demand audience when they start downloading?
Let's see here. Well, we have one question on whether you can set thresholds for SPA, and I'm fairly certain the answer is yes.
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
You can. You can, actually. I would certainly recommend that they go and review that, because I brought Chris Davis with me, the designer, service performance advisor. It's got a lot of cool interactions it can do with allowing you to drill down and interacting with Kirkmon as well. So
yeah.
It certainly does allow you to set thresholds in regards to that. So.
I'm going to interject here real quick for our live audience and just let you know that we have been answering questions throughout this webcast. So if you scroll through that Q&A area on the bottom right-hand side of your screen, you'll be able to see all those questions that have been answered.
So it looks like these are a lot of really technical-type questions in regards to a lot of what Khalil did and in regards to debugging. These are tough. I tell you what, Jeff, I'm looking at these, and I'm like, we're going to be here a while if we actually answer some of these questions. So why don't we do this? You go ahead and continue to submit your questions. Jeff, if you can get you and your gang to stay around and answer those, that would be awesome. And what we can maybe promise to do is we'll get these posted, these questions, out on the blogs.technet.com/MSCom. So if that is an okay solution, what we will do is go ahead and go off the air, and we'll stay around and answer any questions that you have regarding this content or anything we've done this week for certain. You make sure to just promise to sign up and check out blogs.technet.com/MSCom. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and say thank you to everyone for attending, and this will conclude the Microsoft.com Operations Series, a part of the IS Webcast Series. Much appreciated. Everybody have a great afternoon, evening, or night.
Excellent. Thanks, Chris. And I'm just going to remind everybody once again, your feedback is valuable, so please do take a moment to fill that survey prior to logging out. So that concludes this TechNet Live meeting, so I'd like to thank you all for joining us, and you may now disconnect from the audio portion of this event.